Well, the only person talking about love and brother is the preacher.
Welcome to Disrespectfully Agree with Oatman and LJ. I am LJ. Across from me is Mr. Oatman.
Oat, modern off the great.
Segregation, determination, demonstration, integration, aggravation, humiliation, obligation to my nation.
We're talking this week about Black Klansman.
Yeah, say that.
Directed and co-written by Spike Lee. This is a Spike Lee joint. And I think in the opening bit it said a joint based on a for real story.
Yes.
I think I heard this story years ago on an NPR or something or other. Movie's about Ron Stallworth. He was the first Black police officer, I think, in the Colorado Springs area back in the 70s, and he decides to basically go undercover on the phone with the Klan to kind of infiltrate that network of perceived terrorists, possibly at the time, and hijinks ensue. We'll start off with some spoiler-free or mostly spoiler-free conversation, then we'll switch over to spoilers, let you know when that happens.
Damn that. He's a Black man. He's not white.
Oh.
Spoiler alert. I gave it away.
This is the title problem again. You did see the title.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Black Klansman.
Yeah.
Fair point. Thought I was giving something away there. Nah. Maybe not.
Mm-mm. And so that...
Oh, David Duke is in it. He's a racist. I'm telling you that now. I'm putting that out there.
I think that's well known.
Is that well known?
I think people know that.
It's not a spoiler?
No.
All right.
I mean, he was head of the KKK.
All right, there's that. I mean, I guess if you're going to judge somebody just on their job, fine.
Well, I mean, you know, it's like if you're the... If you're the head of a group of cobblers, you kind of expect them to know how to put a shoe together. Oatman, how was the film?
I enjoyed it. I think it's part of sort of a new, maybe not new, but shall I say expanding art form or genre, if you will. A good buddy of mine named David Williams, a fabulous playwright out of the Pittsburgh area, did a paper once I read on ab realism about something that essentially starts in a fairly realistic setting and pretty soon sort of spins out into this increasingly fantastic world and situations that occur. And this reminds me of that. In some ways, it reminds me of that Stalin movie, Death of Stalin.
Mm-hmm.
It has some elements of that. I think it also has some elements of Drunk History to a degree, where it's sort of a real world, but it's also very fanciful in some ways, with almost a comic sensibility imposed on top of it. This is what this film has shades of. I don't know that it fits that perfectly, but I think it has some elements to it that remind me of that stuff.
It's tonally kind of all over the map.
It is.
A little bit. And I don't necessarily think that's bad.
It's not. It's tonally all over the map. I mean, it goes from almost ludicrous and silly to comic to serious to political.
Yeah, there's certain scenes where it's just like, okay, we're doing prank calls here, everybody. Gather around the phone. We're going to laugh.
Exactly.
To, oh, all right, there's something real happening here.
Even the visual language of the film has an over-the-top, almost comic feel to it at times to me. The way in which some of the scenes are shot, like the opening scene, is him sitting here and there are these two fat guys on the other side. Not fat guys, but these two older guys that are on the other side and they're kind of looking at him and they're shooting these questions.
Oh, yeah,
The whole feel of that scene feels like it's from a comic film.
Yes.
As opposed to something more serious. And then you get other films that are just deadly serious. I mean, and then they all mix together in this hodgepodge of story making it. And some might be tempted to say that it's a mess. and in a sense it is, but sure. It works, I think. I think it works here.
Yeah.
I think it's a purposeful mess, if you will, of different styles. But all of it has a surrealistic sheen that's over almost every scene in some ways.
It's an interesting hodgepodge. There are many very traditional scenes and kind of traditional narrative moments and editing stuff. Scenes where the tension builds and there's intrigue and there's action and all of that. And then there's also a series of sequences here and there that are just kind of like, we're just going to do this for a while. I'll give two examples. One is early in the film, Stallworth attends a speech given by a member of the Black Panthers.
And they do that whole faces motif.
They do the faces motif, which is seemed a little bit indulgent for me, but...
A little bit?
A little indulgent.
It's a lot of bit indulgent.
You're right. It had a feel of like what you might expect in like a high production value mega church telethon, almost. Or you get these vignettes of the silhouetted heads, you know, just with the wide eyes and everything.
Well, you know what I called it? I called there are always these moments in a Spike Lee film that are just signature pieces. Mm-hmm. There are pieces to say, this is a Spike Lee joint. Mm-hmm. And that's what that is. He has certain indulgences that are very just Spike Lee. And mm-hmm. that was a very Spike Lee motif kind of moment.
That's his Hitchcock is getting off the bus.
Exactly. I mean, he just has sort of, you know, like even at the end of the picture. And I love the scene, but that scene where there's a knock at the door.
I want to talk about that in spoilers. Okay. I have that moment specifically I want to talk about. And so I was sitting there and I was thinking, are we doing the whole speech? I was like, yeah, we're doing the whole speech. Like,
oh, yeah.
Okay, mm-hmm. fine. I was with it. But there was a scene shortly after that. Ron and his love interest, Patrice, played by Laura Harrier, who you might remember as the girl that Peter Parker takes to Homecoming in Spider-Man Homecoming, Michael Keaton's daughter.
I have no clue what you're talking about.
You didn't see Spider-Man Homecoming?
I did, but I didn't remember the girl. I mean,
Michael Keaton's daughter.
Is black?
Yeah.
Michael Keaton's daughter is black?
Yes.
When did that happen?
What do you mean? That was the whole thing. Peter Parker's lusting after or pining after this girl, the popular girl in school. That's this girl, Laura.
No, I remember that. But
and he shows up to pick her up.
Is that Michael Keaton's biological daughter?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, his wife's black.
No, she's not.
Yes, she was.
Michael Keaton was married to a black woman.
Yep. How'd you miss this?
I don't know.
What the hell happened? Like, that was the whole thing. He knocks on her door, and there's the Vulture standing there. Michael Keaton opens the door. We're like, oh, shit. And it was the whole thing. And that's when the movie got good.
I missed all of that. I don't know what you're talking about.
Wow.
Missed that whole thing.
Normally, I wouldn't recommend this, but you're going to have to watch Spider-Man Homecoming again.
I think I fell asleep on it.
Oh, well, there you go.
So that's his daughter in real life?
Well, in the movie.
In the movie, okay.
It's not technically not real life.
Okay.
Not literally.
Okay, just caught it. Okay, I'm there. All right. I'm with you.
In any case, they go to a club or a bar with a club in the back, a disco in the back or something, and they dance to a song. I forget. It's a great song. I can't remember what it was now, but the lyrics were all, you know, falling in love or whatever, and they're singing along to it. And that scene lasts forever.
Yeah.
And I guess that's kind of like a replacement for actual scenes in which we see these characters actually fall in love. Like from there, we're supposed to be like, yeah, they're in love. Like, no, they never... At no point did I ever buy their relationship.
No.
And also,
I agree.
I feel like, and now I'm dumping on the film. I'll come back to things I like. But not for one moment did I ever buy Laura Harrier as this militant black activist. The words never felt comfortable in her mouth. The language of the time and just the kind of anger of the time that I would expect to see personified in this character never felt real for me.
That felt real. I didn't buy the romance. I did buy her as the activist. That absolutely felt real. It's layers to it.
She seems way too sweet.
That's why it felt real to me.
Really?
Yeah. There is sort of a trope in the African-American community of the angry mulatto.
Look, I'm not trying to say she needs to be angry militant. I'm just saying she just seems like her heart's not in it to me.
No, that's why I bought it.
Oh, okay.
She plays to me like a lot of tropes that I've seen, both in film and also in real life, where you run into this girl who is light-skinned, and she's gone to prep school her whole life mm-hmm. and lived in the suburbs.
Oh, I see.
And then all of a sudden she discovers, wait a minute, I'm black, and then she picks her hair out, and she's this radical. And oftentimes,
you're saying she's putting on a role.
That's how I bought her. She was one of those people that those people are always the most judgmental. Mm. They're like new converts. They're the most you dirty pig. And she's talking to him.
I would have liked to have seen that in this film.
I thought I saw it. I thought I saw that. I
would like to have seen the film address it.
I thought it did.
Well, first, let me ask you this. I've not seen a lot of Spike Lee's films, so you're going to have to answer this question for me.
I've seen all of them. Everyone.
Does Spike Lee have a subtle bone in his body?
He does.
This film does not have one. He hits his themes over the head multiple times. I mean, there are scenes that are just like... Going back to our solo.
What's ironic about it is you just stated one of the most subtle themes of the movie and then said, does he have a subtle bone?
Because I don't think it's in there.
It's there. It's just, you know why you don't see it? It's subtle.
No.
It is. It's there. It's there. That tension that comes before, oftentimes, and what's really ironic is, because, you know, Spike Lee is always playing with color games in terms of skin, you know, mm-hmm. that's his thing, the wannabes and the jigaboos. Mm-hmm. And she's clearly a wannabe. And he's clearly a dark jigaboo who's sort of on the darker side of things. And here's this wannabe who's light-skinned or a little lighter, who has some level of privilege probably, and probably comes from a higher socioeconomic background, talking to an actual jigaboo who's on the front lines of racism, getting judgmental to him about what racism is and isn't and all of that.
But neither he nor any of the other characters in the piece seem to imply that dichotomy.
It's there.
I see that you see it's there. It's a trope you're familiar with, and you see it as there. For me, it's without that knowledge, the film offers no commentary.
Oh, I get it. It's subtle.
On that.
It's very subtle, but it's a theme that he's talked about over and over again. It's a constant theme in his work. So not only is it a trope that I've seen before, being familiar with Spike Lee's work, it's a theme that he has talked about in Jungle Fever. It's a theme he's talked about in School Days. Certainly it's a theme that he hit over and over and over in Do the Right Thing and all of these different films. He's always playing. He wrote an entire musical number that's
maybe,
all about
maybe the
that.
Reason it's not there enough for me is because he feels like, well, I've established this already.
Yeah, it's there.
But then... We get to all of the stuff where...
I think it's clear with her character that she's a bit of a wannabe. She's not a frontline warrior. She's some college student in some mostly white suburb who has her hair picked out. And she cares about the movement, no doubt. But she's a bit of a wannabe. And she's a newer convert. That's why she's so...
Yeah, I don't think the film portrays her as that. I really don't.
I think it does.
I think it portrays her as the orthodoxy.
No, there's nothing in there that really sells her as that.
I agree. I think it doesn't work.
No, but I think I don't know that it's supposed to work.
Yeah, I gotcha. But yeah. I want to go back to, if I may, back to our solo review. I said there should be a guy in the corner just pointing his like, recognize that? There's a number of scenes in here that just, and dialogue moments are just like, this is Trump. This is the last election. There are moments or scenes just like, hey, we're going to have a conversation out of nowhere about 2016.
I agree.
And it's as unsubtle and unnuanced as it gets. And I've been going back and forth on this. It was like, I hated it initially. My gut reaction was, this is bad. This is inelegant. This is unnecessary. And I've done some soul searching on this. And I thought, well, maybe that's appropriate. Maybe we need a cudgel on some of these ideas. But again, you're much more of an expert on Spike Lee than I. Just based on this film, it seems like the man, if he's got a point to make, he's just going to have his characters say it.
I think yes and no. I think Spike Lee is very much a mirror of his films. I think he's a mixed bag. I think at times he can be super subtle, and then there are other times in which he hits you with a hammer. I think he does both at the same time. So I think there are a lot of this movie, you're right, it's just a hammer. But I think a lot of it is fairly subtle. I think almost subtle to the point that you miss some of it. Especially some of the visual language was really subtle. Some of it was interesting.
Give me an example.
I think the way in which everything in the film is done in hyper-realization, like every afro was super huge.
Was really big.
Was huge. I mean, it was almost like a funhouse mirror of itself. And I don't know that people picked that up immediately of how every image in it is almost a sort of a funhouse mirror of itself.
Well, John David Washington, the guy who plays Ron Stallworth and the son of Denzel, he is doing almost a cartoon caricature voice for most of it. Even Absolutely. When he's not playing the white guy.
Absolutely.
He's doing something that's very kind of put on a little bit and heightened
but,
to an
But it's consistent
degree.
For everybody.
No, I gotcha.
Yeah, every character is almost a hyper-realized version. But it's one of those things where he doesn't go so far that it slips into farce, but it's far enough that it's not quite rooted in a
There's one scene that
in a straight drama.
That I want to talk about when we get into spoilers. Okay. But yeah.
But yeah, he finds this, he operates in this weird middle place. And, yeah. and it comes back to where I talked about my friend David Williams, ab realism, where it's in this weird place where it's not quite rooted in reality, mm-hmm. but it's not quite far enough to be open farce. And it's operating in this weird middle space, but he keeps that tone consistently, and he holds it pretty much throughout
the film.
Well,
he keeps, the wildly inconsistent tone very consistently.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's a skilled thing, because after a while, once you realize that it permeates throughout the whole film, it's not by accident. That's something that the filmmaker is intentionally doing. That is a lever he is intentionally pulling time and time again.
It almost feels Brechtian in some senses.
Absolutely. It definitely has some shades of Brecht. Certainly, I mean, just
which worked against me at times.
I thought it was okay. I mean, it was one of those things that once he made the contract with me so early in the film that I finally just said, okay, I'm going to give in to this weird thing and just let it.
Let's talk about the opening of this film, which I forgot about until I looked at the cast list. Alec Baldwin is in this movie at the beginning. Plays Dr. Kennebrew Beauregard?
I hated the beginning of this film.
What's going on with that?
I did not like the beginning. I didn't get it. And not only that, what really pissed me off is it was Alec Baldwin.
Yeah.
That's what angered me more than anything.
Why?
Because Alec Baldwin is such a multi-skilled, multi-tool, multifaceted, amazing actor. He's amazing to look at. He's a really good actor. I just felt like, what a waste. If you're going to take out Alec Baldwin and pay him 2 or 3 weekends to do a shoot on your film, do something with him. Don't have him do that shit. I mean, anybody could have did that. I was like, what is this?
Yeah, it seemed like just the first salvo against, look at how absurd and stupid these people are.
But I didn't even get that from it. It was weird. It was one of those things where, and I've had this experience as a director, where you have an idea and a concept, and then you go and you do it, and you're like, well, that didn't work.
That didn't work.
I mean, I knew where I was going when I started, but boy, that just went nowhere. And yeah. I've done that. I've seen it.
But that could. But,
we've done that together, LJ.
Sure.
We've traveled.
Yeah.
Traveled that road together.
That was an interesting experience.
like, wow, boy, did that not work.
Yeah.
But he kept it in for some reason.
Yeah, that's it.
And I guess it's one of those things where it's like, well, it's Alec Baldwin. What am I going to do? Cut it.
Right, yeah.
But
that's fair. Yeah.
It didn't work. Whatever they were shooting for, it didn't work. And it's one of our greatest living actors. I love Alec Baldwin. I think he does really good work. But that was some garbage.
Yeah, I'm not sure what happened there.
Yeah.
Let's jump into spoilers.
Warning.
There's a scene in this movie that I loved. It's almost out of place in its sincerity. When Ron Stallworth shows up at the precinct with his membership card to the KKK, and he hands it over to Han Solo's kid. What's his name? Adam Driver. And he has this kind of monologue about being Jewish in that community and not really thinking about what that meant and thinking about passing kind of for the first time. And he ends that moment with, I don't want that. He hands it back. I don't want this. I thought it was a really strong, poignant. Of all the characters in this movie, he's the one that kind of has the biggest arc. I don't think any of the other characters really change that much. But his moment, that moment right there with him, I thought was really strong.
It was okay.
Really?
It was. I mean, it was fine. I mean, it was a little, you know, it reminds me of a scene from Don't Drink Your Juice in the Hood or whatever that movie was.
It was
don't drink your juice in South Central or something.
It's like don't be a menace to South Central while drinking your juice in the hood.
Yeah, exactly.
Ah, got it.
And there's a scene from that film where they come in and like, message, and it kind of felt like that kind of moment to me. It was a showy moment in a quiet way. It was like, and not that it wasn't good. It was well done. I liked the scene. I'm not knocking the scene, but it just had that. I kind of felt, and this is going to come out wrong, and I'm going to say it inelegantly first. I could feel the emotional manipulation in that scene. That was the director pulling my strings, and I could feel it. It was so sentimental in a way, and I was like, okay, I'll go with it. I mean, I'm enjoying it. I'm enjoying the ride so far. And Driver's such a good actor.
I thought he was great in that scene.
I thought he was wonderful in the whole film.
I
think he's great in this. What is the deal with the other actor, though? Was that actor in costume or something?
Which actor?
The other actor that played the other cop on the task force, the older guy.
You're talking
guy.
About not Steve Buscemi?
Is that Steve Buscemi?
No, it's Michael Buscemi.
Okay. I mean, I was like, why does he look like somebody else? Is he wearing...
He looks like Steve Buscemi.
I was like, is he wearing a... I thought he was wearing some kind of costume or something, or like
I think all of the characters technically were wearing costumes.
No, you son of a bitch. I'm saying, I thought he was doing something with his face, like he was hiding his face, like he was wearing makeup or something.
He's a Buscemi.
Oh, no wonder. That bothered me the whole film. Because I was like, is there going to be some kind of reveal with him? Because he looks like...
It's like Mission Impossible. He's going to take off his mask.
Yeah, it looked like he had stuff.
But it was Tom Cruise the whole time.
I was seeing Steve Buscemi's face peeking through his face.
Yeah, well, there's a reason, turns out.
And Topher was great, by the way.
Yeah, he was good.
He was a very good David Duke.
Let's talk about that.
Maybe a little too good.
Oh.
No.
Methinks he does protest too much. Let's talk about the Birth of a Nation scene.
Mm-hmm.
There was an interesting article I was hip to on Screen Crush by Matt Singer, where he talks about the way Spike Lee used this film in this film. And if you're not familiar with Birth of a Nation, it is one of the first blockbuster in American cinema.
It's considered the first modern film.
Okay. The director there employed a lot of new techniques.
Tracking shots.
And one of the techniques he used was parallel editing. Now, this film, Birth of a Nation, is a racist film. And is incredibly racist and is credited for helping to give rebirth to the KKK in this nation.
Based on a racist book.
Yeah.
Screened in the White House for Woodrow Wilson.
Yeah. And interestingly, during the scene in which the members of the KKK screen this movie, there is a parallel edited scene with Harry Belafonte giving an account of a real lynching.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't occur to me at the time. I mean, I understood what he was doing. I understood the technique and why he was putting these two scenes together. But it didn't occur to me till I read this article. I was like, oh, that's okay. Now that's clever. He took the technique that one of the techniques used.
It was subtle.
Yeah, it was. I'll grant you that. It was. And use that tool to demonize as a tool against the oppressors in a really interesting way, now that I look on it in retrospect.
Yeah, it was a wonderful scene. Yeah, Birth of a Nation, that was such a groundbreaking film. What's so amazing about it is, I think it also speaks to another truth, that no matter who you are, black, white, or green, you can't be a filmmaker and not be influenced by that film. That as racist as it was, if you're a black filmmaker, you still cleave to some of the techniques introduced by that film. So even though you may be black, in some way you're still a child of Birth of a Nation.
Sure.
When you go to make films, which is a fascinating dichotomy that basically speaks to the history of America. You know, I may be Mike, some black guy from East Cleveland, but I'm still in some ways a child of slave owners. I'm the child of George Washington and Jefferson and some of the things they do. I'm a child of that culture that they created. As a filmmaker, he's a child of D.W. Griffin, which is fascinating.
Yeah. And for...
Who, by the way, made another film after that to make up for it called Intolerance.
Really?
Which ended up destroying his life. he wanted to dispel racist notions.
Hmm.
So he made this other epic film called Intolerance, which became a disaster. He became an alcoholic and ended up having his life destroyed by this film that decried racism, actually, in all its forms, called Intolerance.
Interesting.
A little bit of trivia.
So for as much as I was given Spike Lee grief for being perhaps too bludgeonly with his messages, the final bit of this movie was footage of Charlottesville and the
message.
Yeah. So we get Charlottesville, we get the footage of the guy, who was it, who ran over people?
Yeah, I forget his name. The guy ran into the crowd and killed that woman.
So we get that footage, and again, it's bludgeonly. But I was thinking about it again, and you know, Laura Ingraham, I don't want to get too political, but it's a political film. I guess we have to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
Laura Ingraham...
Scumbag.
Just a couple of weeks ago...
Oh, sorry.
Laura Ingraham, just a couple of weeks ago, on the most popular news network in this country, was talking about how horrible it is that this country has been subjected to demographic changes that the American people, quote-unquote, did not ask for and didn't vote for. I'm just like, you know, Spike Lee's right. For as much as I'm... You know, I look at this film like, oh, yeah, we get it. Okay. He's right. I mean, things have gone from underground this kind of rhetoric to dog whistles to just saying it. Yeah, people feel comfortable saying this stuff.
Yeah, they've created a language in which they can express that. And it was started some years ago with dog whistles and has graduated to a full articulated language that you can shout at the top of your lungs in the public square.
The mainstreamification of white nationalist rhetoric is real.
Yeah, it's just sort of, in some ways, it's kind of nostalgic. It's like it's going back to our roots.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's just, that's all. We're just going back to our roots, which was always there. We just were pretending for 50 or 60 years. Now we're just kind of settling back into what our history is, what our roots are. That's all.
Yeah.
It's no different than what people were saying in the 1820s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 1920s, 1930s. It's the same thing, same rhetoric. A matter of fact, America First, which Donald Trump uses, that's something he took directly from sort of a racist.
Yeah.
Race-based, nationalistic
idea.
Idea, you know.
But I want to go out on some kind of positive note.
Racism
here.
Racism is the new black. No pun intended.
I want to go out on a somewhat positive note here. There was a protest recently. Uh-huh. The white nationalists, rally. They were planning it, and not as many people showed up, and a whole lot of anti-protesters did. It was... And again, it's a moment in time.
Discouraging.
Discouraging? How so?
Because it just means that the reason that you don't have as many protesters is because they don't have to protest anymore. They can just go on Fox.
Well, maybe that's the reason. I was trying to go out on a positive note.
I wish I could. I mean, the reason that you only had 20 people gathering there is because they don't have to go to those places to embody those ideals. All they have to do now is run for Congress or go on Fox.
But they had that anyway. I mean, a year ago, there was a lot more fervor.
No, they haven't had the level of language and freedom to express their views. Like, 5 years ago, I don't think a host could have came on there and did what Laura Ingraham did and not have any uprise about it, even on Fox News. Yeah. You've even seen a shift there. Like, you literally have, I have watched in a very short span of time, people go from being Tea Partiers who hate Barack Obama and not sure that he is a member of the American citizenry and that he's some sleeper agent. Mm-hmm. I've gone from those guys coming out screaming at the top of their lungs to the fact that those guys aren't conservative anymore. They're being ran out of the party now because they're not stringent enough.
Yeah.
guys like Corker and the Freedom Caucus guys. The Freedom Caucus guys are on the run. Because they're not conservative enough, whatever that means, or they're not stringent enough on things like affirmative action or stringent enough on things like immigration. So I've gone from those guys being the far right edge of the party to now almost being liberals. So you got the Jeff Flakes of the world and the Corkers of the world.
They're the establishment now.
Barely. Yeah. They're getting run out.
Yeah.
So that's a shift that's happened really in the last.
That's true. We went from. All right, we're getting way too political. This movie review show.
No, but I mean that's the context of the movie.
You're right. I mean that's where Spike Lee's coming from. That's what he's seeing. That's what he's commenting upon.
So yeah, it's sad that there are only 20 people that show up for that rally. It's only 20 people because why go do that when you can run for Congress and you can say the exact same thing. David Duke is right. He's right and he's prescient when he says, hey, Donald Trump just stole my material. Everything that I've been running on, he's running on everything. He uses the exact same language. He uses the exact same news sources. He is just me with worse hair. That's all. But yeah, that's the point that the film is making. And you're right. He even has his characters at one point says it. That we'll have a guy in the White House that are espousing these views. And right now, that's what you have. We have a white nationalist who is in the White House. And I'm not even saying anything that's something he hasn't said. I mean, he's espousing.
There's good people on both sides.
Yeah, he's espousing and defending white nationalism. And he's done that openly.
Yeah, and he never criticizes them, really.
Never criticizes them. He said that Mexicans are breeders. He called them rapists and murderers.
Yeah.
First black president didn't belong to this citizenry.
No.
I mean, he's been pretty open. I mean,
I agree. I want to get back to the movie for a second.
Back to the movie.
So I want to briefly talk about the narrative. of the film, which I think doesn't add up that well. It seems like he's trying to have a traditional kind of thriller conclusion climax to this thing. But oddly, like if the heroes had done nothing, the same thing would have happened because the bad guys were so bumbling that they killed themselves. It was a weird moment. We've got a white woman in this movie. She can't plant the bomb at the house because there's too many things going on, too many people around. So she goes to the girl's house, but it's too big for the mailbox.
I love that scene.
So it was a fun scene. And I mean, it was almost Coen Brothers-esque, that whole thing. So she goes and plants it underneath the car. And then Ron Stallworth, you know, and this is actually a great moment. Ron Stallworth, you know, stops her and tries to arrest her. And then cops come and try to arrest him, which was all very telling and message and all that. But it was fine. And then the other bad guys show up and park next to the bomb car and surely would have an eye line to the other cops. Like they're just going to blow up this house. It didn't make any sense in the first place. And then they blow themselves up, of course, ironically, because they're bumbling idiots. And it's just like if nothing had happened, if none of the good guys did anything, the same result would have happened.
I suppose that's a point. I suppose that's a point.
It just seems like he's trying to make an action movie or a thriller climax where none exists.
One of my questions would be, and I don't know if this is relevant or not, is what actually happened.
Yeah, I had that question too.
Because sometimes the reason you get like an awkward, stupid scene is that the director is foolishly trying to adhere to some level of truth.
Yeah, I wondered about that. I thought, well, if you're going to do this, just do it.
Yeah, that's what I said.
If you want to do an action thriller, just make it an action thriller. If it's going to be real, make it real. This was kind of like, I think he's trying to do both, and it doesn't work.
So I'm wondering what actually happened. Is he following some schematic of truth that he's trying to dramatize or whatever? Because you're right, it was a very awkward scene in some ways.
And this was the first thing I wanted to bring up, I forgot about, was there's a scene where... It seems almost out of nowhere where they're at a bar or whatever, and the racist cop comes in and starts saying some racist stuff, and...
Was that not an awful scene?
It was awful.
It made no sense.
And they recorded him say that.
That's the worst scene of the film.
Of the film. And the chief of police comes out, almost like it's a candid camera thing. He's like, we got you, rascal.
We got you, you crazy.
You're under arrest.
You crazy racist cop.
You little rascal, yeah. And I'm thinking, well, first of all, what did he say that is a crime?
Exactly. What did he say that is exculpatory? It made no sense.
It was just like, hey, feel good, kind of, but it...
But it wasn't feel good. It was so stupid.
It was dumb, and it didn't make sense for any of the other characters in the scene.
Well, not only that, none of the characters acted like their characters.
No. It just seemed like a sketch all out of nowhere.
Because I remember when he was saying the stuff to her, I'm like, why is Ron Stallworth sitting there taking that? That makes no sense. Ron Stallworth that we've seen throughout this film would have decked that guy a long time ago. So it was just such a... At first, you know what I thought it was, what it looked like? It looked like some kind of weird dream sequence or something.
Which brings me to my third point. What you mentioned was the weird kind of dolly shot.
Yes.
Where the two, there's talk of some blaxploitation films and stuff, and this was the two characters kind of with their
great
guns.
Shot.
It was a great shot. But they're on this dolly and the camera, they're going along with the camera down this hallway, and they see outside the window this burning cross, of course. Mm-hmm. And I thought to myself, is this a dream? Because it was like this stylized thing out of nowhere. And maybe, as you were saying, it's like this is one of his things.
Well, that's his thing. You know, that's his signature shot.
Okay.
He has a great one. He has them all throughout his films.
Okay.
There's a real great one in Malcolm X. When Malcolm X is about to go die at the Audubon Ballroom, he's on this dolly and he's just floating.
Mm-hmm.
And so he does this shot time and time and time and time and time again. It's a Spike Lee shot.
Yeah, it just seemed, I guess.
And he does that with his endings, too.
Okay.
Well, he'll open his endings up to sort of this weird...
But it just turns into this magical...
Yeah, he does that all the time. Like in School Days, the last scene is the character getting up, banging a bell, telling everybody to wake up, and then everybody gets up, and all the characters come out and gather around, like, what's happening? And then he's looking into the camera saying, wake up. And that's the end of the film. Like,
okay.
What the hell is that? And I tend to hate those endings.
Right.
I want something more concrete. I thought this one of the ones that he does, it looked good. I thought it looked good. And then it did that transition into the burning. I was like, oh, okay. That's a Spike Lee thing, I guess.
I guess.
Yeah.
And then there's that scene back at the precinct when they're all like patting each other on the back and high fives and shaking hands and laughing and all that. And I'm just like, this doesn't seem right.
That one was a little closer for me, but I get what you're saying. The tone of it was off.
It was weird.
Like, you could almost do that same scene, but it's the way in which it was done that just seemed tonally off.
And maybe it's just because it came right after the scene where they...
Yeah, but not only that, the lead actor is tonally interesting.
He's kind of, yeah.
He shifts tonally in weird ways.
He goes back and forth between being in a comedy. Yeah. It's like his performance is like, it goes also from comedy to drama back and forth, but you know, it's been brought up before that Chappelle Show sketch of the black guy who's secretly a Klansman.
Yeah, I love that.
The blind black Klansman. There were times where Washington almost dived into that kind of Chappelle show when Chappelle does a white guy voice.
Absolutely. There are times in which this thing could have easily been a Chappelle sketch.
Yeah.
Easily. Not just by the situation, but by the actual tone and performance that we're seeing on screen. Like I said, it doesn't quite tip into Chappelle, but boy, it's a hair off, boy. It's right there.
It gets his feet wet.
It definitely gets his feet wet.
In the end, you know, it's a mixed bag of a film. I enjoyed it. I think it's good.
I enjoyed it too. I give it a solid B.
Sure. Yeah, I'll go with that.
Yeah, solid B. I wouldn't give it an A. I wouldn't give it a B+, but I give it a solid B.
It's entertaining. It's interesting. It's got a lot of good things to say.
And the visual language of it is interesting.
Yes.
Like, for any filmmaker, I would bring them this as an example of film not only can tell stories, but it can also be beautiful.
Yeah.
It could also be visually interesting and arresting at times. There are a lot of scenes in here that are visually arresting. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah, he is an artist, and he takes chances.
He does.
Doesn't always work out.
Mm-mm, not at all.
But you know what? Good on him.
Yeah, good on them. Keep swinging for the fences, brother. It's one of the things I always liked about Kevin Costner. When he misses, he misses big.
Boy, I did not think we'd be talking about Kevin Costner in this episode.
You know, when you look at Postman, oh my God, Waterworld, boy.
He didn't direct that one, to be fair, but Postman, that was him.
That was him.
And
but Waterworld, he didn't direct it, but he was heavily involved.
Sure. Yes. And, absolutely.
Wow, that was rough. And if somebody asked him, would he ever make a Waterworld again? And he was like, yeah. He's like, I believe in swinging for the fences.
Yeah.
And if I miss, I miss. You know, okay.
There's that one scene in The Postman, the worst scene in the whole thing. It was so self-indulgent. It was him, you know, there's that boy who just misses him.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And he goes past it. He gets his sixth sense. He's like, did I miss somebody? I turn around. There's a boy there. He's got a litter. And I'm going to gallop full speed going the wrong way and grab that litter only so I can turn back around again, I assume. And go the direction I intended. Why full speed?
Why is that necessary?
Why is that necessary? Why are we doing full speed? And then, of course, we immortalize that dumb moment that nobody else saw with a statue. My God. And you know what else is what makes it worse? What? That boy was his son.
Oh, yes.
His real-life son.
Oh, my God. I didn't know that. That I didn't know. it was tough.
In any case, that does it for us this week, everybody. We went on a wild ride. Give us a review on the Apple Podcast app if you'd be so kind. Tell a friend about the show.
Make sure to send us out to Trump supporters.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Tell an enemy about the show. And we will talk at you next week. Bye.
Peace and chicken grease. Big booga booga, can't you hear me talking to you? It's a ball of the people, yeah. Let me hear, let me hear, let me hear. Or
a
lot of people complained about his Wyatt Earp, which was...
Did he direct that? I don't think he directed
that. He didn't direct it, but you know...
It was a Kazdan movie.
It was a Kazdan movie, but what I found out a lot about Kevin Costner as I looked into him is that oftentimes he produces or he is heavily involved in the film and the vision of it.
Sure.
And
Tom Cruise-like.
Yeah, Tom Cruise-like in that way. He's very heavily involved in his films. Like, he's one of those people that believes in a project and will help ferret it to the screen. And Wyatt Earp was one of those pictures. He'd always wanted to do his story. And like, from what I understand, that beginning part was because of Kevin Costner, that they didn't have that beginning part of him growing up and with the brothers, that the original piece had it starting kind of when the movie really starts.
Right. Where it should have started.
Where it should have started. But he wanted that whole beginning where he's buffalo hunting and, you know, he's just a kid. And who cares?
Yeah.
Could you get a pistol and shoot somebody? I mean, that's really why we're here. That's what we're
This episode's already over an hour long, so I'm going to have to cut a lot of this out. But I was thinking of our discussion of the last Mission Impossible movie, Fallout. Mm-hmm. I learned that movie was basically improvised.
Really?
It was like improvisational filmmaking. Like Tom Cruise had scenes, action scenes he wanted to do, and McQuarrie was like, okay, all right, we'll figure out the rest as we go.
Hmm.
Now it all makes sense.
Like NYPD Blue.
Oh, okay.
The guy who was the showrunner there. During the Jimmy Smits years, he developed, it's not funny, he developed a heroin cocaine habit.
Okay.
And so what would happen, Jimmy Smits, they figured out why Jimmy Smits left the show was that he would get these full scripts and he would do the script and tape it. And then pretty soon the scripts start getting smaller and more sparse and then they would improvise certain scenes.
This was, you're talking about the creator got on.
Yeah, who did NYPD Blue?
I can't remember.
Yeah, so.
But the creator got on a drug habit.
Got a drug habit. And he said by the end of his addiction, Jimmy Smits said that there were no scripts and that the dude would just show up and say, okay. Totally wired on drugs. And he's like, okay, so Jimmy, so you're going to come in and you're going to be like, hey, you can't take my drugs. And then you're going to come in and you're going to be like, hey, I could take that if I want to take it. And he would talk them through the scenes. And so they said that the guy who played Sipowicz, I forget his name, he loved the process. He thought it was fresh and it took him back to his days in theater. And right. he thought, Jimmy Smith's like, this is insanity. He was like, I need a script. I can't work this way. Yeah. And then he left the show.
This is madness.
This is madness.
Yeah, it's not quite, I don't think it's drug-addled so much as, let's just do a show.
Yeah, let's do a show. Yeah, let's make it happen. We know how to do this.
Yeah, so now it all kind of makes sense why
that does make sense.
Nothing makes sense.
Yeah, we have a basic story.
we have a framework for what we're roughly going to happen, and we'll figure out why it happens later.